Hello and welcome to South Asia Chat, a podcast series brought to you by the Institute of South Asian Studies at the National University of Singapore. I'm Tanuja Dadlani, research analyst at ISS, and I'll be your host for today's episode. Increasingly, technology forms a critical part of how South Asian countries diplomatically interact and cooperate with external partners, as well as through frameworks like the BRI, IPEF, and the Quad. In this episode, we'll be looking at some key aspects related to strategic technologies that are shaping the region, including India's Digital Public Infrastructure, its Data Protection Act, as well as how it is adapting to and countering the rise of technology geopolitics around the world today. We're excited to welcome Dr. Karthik Nachiappan, Research Fellow and Research Lead for the Strategic Technologies Cluster here at ISS. Welcome, Dr. Nachiappan.
Thank you so much for having me.
India's digital public infrastructure has witnessed rapid progress and was one of the highlights during its G20 presidency last year. Can India's DPI be a template for other developing countries, and how accessible and transferable are DPIs?
So the short answer is it can be. The DPIs are a true and unalloyed success for the Indian government. So what they are essentially are a set of interoperable open source software platforms that allow different kinds of digital services to be delivered. What initially began with Aadhaar, which is the biometric digital identity database, in 2009 in India, has now become a collective digital architecture which has immense practical relevance and implications for Indian citizens. So what you see now from the initial Aadhaar system is a set of services that's being designed for people to use. So you have what is probably the anchor, the Unified Payments Interface, UPI, which allows people to make payments to one another. There's COVID, which the government used to manage vaccination program during COVID-19. There's DigiLocker, which is a system for storing and sharing digital documents for different activities and purposes. And there are additional digital infrastructures and architectures that are being designed in other areas like health, education, and so on. So this is a critical success, and this success was heavily highlighted last year when India hosted the G20, which gave way to a lot of calls to then globalize the technology for other developing countries who might find it useful. For low and middle-income countries in particular, who might not have the technical know-how or the resources to start such a system from scratch, the adoption of DPIs is a boon. It can help reduce implementation costs. It can shorten the learning curve through shared lessons, learnings, practices, and technologies that can then hopefully lead to society-wide digitalization. So can it be shared? Yes, the attractions of DPI are obvious. As I mentioned, it can help provide services at scale that to large populations at low cost. And it's really quite appealing. So far, I think at least 8 to 9 countries have signed MOUs with the Indian government for DPIs for the India stack, largely from Africa. And I suspect that list will grow to other parts of the world in the global south, who have also shown a keen interest in adopting different kinds of DPI infrastructures, specifically the payments architecture. Besides, it's not just the developing countries. I think developed countries are also increasingly looking at what India has done and finding it useful. So for example, France and Germany, who have also expressed their interest in importing different aspects of UPI for their own domestic use. So there is an opportunity here, and there is an opportunity that I think the Indian government can exploit and harness to its own advantage.
Another critical issue is that of data privacy. India's Digital Personal Data Protection Act was passed in 2023, almost 6 years after the Indian Supreme Court declared that privacy was a constitutional right for all Indians. Data protection and privacy remain contentious in the Indian context. One of the concerns is the exemptions given to state agencies under the Act. Could you throw some light on the implications of this?
So in August 2023, the Indian Parliament passed its data protection law called the Digital Personal Data Protection Act. This new law is the first cross-sectoral law passed covering personal data protection in India. And it's been passed after almost 5 to 6 years of discussions, deliberations, and consultations. So the 2023 Act, the bill in itself, is a second version of a bill that was introduced in Parliament early on. And it was a fourth version of a bill for personal data. So just a brief history here before I kind of dig into some of these implications. The first version of the bill was prepared by a committee of experts and circulated for feedback in 2018. This was the Sri Krishna Committee. After which the government's version of that bill introduced in Parliament, it was an amended version called, and it was called the Personal Data Protection Bill in 2019. That was then studied by a parliamentary committee. They had consultations with different kinds of state and non-state actors who gave their own feedback on what they would like the eventual bill to look like before it was passed. And then that led to another version of the bill in 2022, which was again open for consultations. The 2023 law is based in significant part on the 2022 bill. And so compared to the 2019 version, the 2023 bill and the law that was passed is much more modest. Initially, it was a lot heavy in terms of obligations. For people handling for people and organizations who are taking care of different kinds of data in India. But the 2023 version is much more modest. It's skimmed down, it's pared, it has reduced the obligations for businesses and firms and organizations handling data, and it's also reduced the kinds of protections for consumers. The regulatory structure is much simpler. There is no massive regulatory authority that would govern or control how the bill would be implemented across different industries. But on the other hand, the law now does vest the central government with considerable amount of discretionary power to determine how it will be implemented. And so there are a lot of questions, as you mentioned, related to the implementation. And a lot of these concerns are tied in with the role of the state and how much power the state has over data protection and the exemptions that are given to the state when it comes to protecting data. And as I said, how much power and access state agencies have to the personal data collected across different kinds of devices in it. And so these exemptions, these exceptions that have been carved out and passed in the current version of the Act, they empower the state considerably, and they place state imperatives on a much different pedestal compared to the kind of obligations that are expected of firms that are handling data. I think in some cases this might be legitimate. So if you look at in situations like disasters or in emergencies, when the state does need more information, and they would need to have access to different kinds of data, then perhaps that can be allowed. But the exemptions given to the state in this particular bill are much more sweeping, which I think raises a lot of concerns. The state is also not subject to many of the constraints that as I mentioned, that the private entities, private firms are. And I think that's also an issue which could come up at some point. Civil society activists have been raising a lot of criticism on this aspect of the bill, the exemptions given to the state, who, and they claim that this effectively is a green light for state surveillance in India. Let's not forget that the Indian government is one of the largest collectors of personal information and data in the world. And this legislation now is essentially gives them carte blanche when it comes to managing, handling, storing, and processing data, and determining what kinds of rules will need to be put in place when data is being transferred from one country, that is from India, to another. So there are a lot of issues with that particular part of the bill, but I think businesses in general in India are happy that it's much more simpler, it's easier to follow and handle. And as some bureaucrats have mentioned, this is the start. This is the start of a regulatory process that can and should hopefully get better and learn over time.
Part of strategic technologies is the advancement of networks around the world, such as faster and more developed mobile networks like 5G. Can India counter China's foothold over developing and installing 5G technology and infrastructure in Asia?
So I think that will be hard. China has a significant advantage, dominance in telecom infrastructure, especially 5G. It's established a comprehensive industrial ecosystem around 5G, which includes 5G networks, chips, devices, terminals, and related industries. China has also been playing an active role in shaping global 5G standards, and it has a lot of the essential IP, the patents in the 5G area, and they're using it to their own advantage. The Chinese government has also delivered tens of billions of dollars in subsidies to different kinds of firms in this area, principally Huawei, and all these things which I've mentioned have led to Huawei becoming a 5G leader. It's a 5G giant in this space. If you look at other countries, other developing countries, why would they prefer 5G over other actors? It's because of everything that I've mentioned so far. It's practically relevant, and it's also economically attractive in terms of issues like product readiness, in terms of costs, in terms of technical and technological support, how quickly they can roll out a 5G network and how quickly they can make it work. I think Huawei is the industry leader right now. And these are things that have been accomplished through massive investment, support from the Chinese state, and support from a large industrial base around 5G. So in this landscape where China and Huawei dominates, other countries are way behind, and they have been trying to catch up from that space. So India and India's partners in Asia and in the Pacific have to really work in a 5G telecom landscape that is dominated by China and Huawei. And that is still relevant for many countries in Southeast Asia and in other parts of the world. So reducing Huawei's dominance in this particular environment situation is hard, and it was always going to be hard. But India has been working multilaterally and bilaterally with its partners to try to do that. So this started from the Trump administration's time in 2017, when the US has been actively discouraging other countries from using Chinese 5G equipment and from supporting Huawei, despite their popularity and their practical relevance. I think the responses of several Asian countries to American calls for a prohibition of Chinese 5G equipment have been varied. So while close US allies have generally followed the American call to avoid incorporating Chinese telecom equipment, including Huawei equipment, there are other Asian countries that have largely put economic considerations above national security concerns and have gone with Huawei. I think India and Vietnam are the only Asian countries that differ in this respect. They have put national security considerations ahead of economic considerations. And they've made a choice, even though it might not be economically rational. Let's not forget that before 2020, when India's break with Huawei came about, India was using Huawei equipment for its 3G and 4G telecom infrastructures, largely because of all the reasons that I've laid out. It's economically cost effective. They provide the entire they provide the entire network. They also support it. So it has been very practically and economically attractive for India until the geopolitical issues with China arose across the border in 2020, after which India then went back on their decision to support Huawei and removed it from its 5G landscape. Since then, India has been working with the US and other partners to reduce regional dependence on Huawei. It's supporting other kinds of technologies, principally ORAN, which is the Open Random Access Network, which is a set of decentralized telecom solutions that countries can use for their own 5G and 6G needs. But all these are pretty nascent and early in their own development and will take some time to really scale up to challenge China and Huawei's dominance. So it's a tough ask. It's something that the Indian government has been engaged in off late. It's been relying also on European vendors for 5G and 6G. It's been developing its own 5G systems, largely Jio, and has been working with the US to reduce regional Asian dependence on Huawei. Whether that is going to be enough, it remains to be seen.
Moving on to the Quad, a diplomatic partnership between Australia, India, Japan, and the United States. What is your assessment of the Quad's critical and emerging technologies working group, and how can India effectively contribute?
So the Quad has been a work in progress ever since Biden came to power in 2021, which is when it started moving from its initial security focus to what it is now, which is a public goods mechanism, a provider of regional public goods in areas like health, climate, and importantly, critical and emerging technologies. The discussions on this particular subject take place in a working group called the Critical and Emerging Technologies Working Group. That was created in 2021 after the first Quad Leaders Summit. Back then, the focus was to ensure that technology standards are governed by what they call shared interests and values of all Quad nations. So they agreed to work on standards on issues like 5G, telecom, biotech, and supply chains. This initial focus was then reaffirmed in 2022 when again the leaders met at the Quad Summit in Tokyo. At that summit, AI entered the picture, and all the Quad countries then began having discussions on how they can create rules, standards, and guardrails around AI. Since then, there have been a number of initiatives that's followed on this front. There's been the official launch of a fellowship for STEM students in all four countries. That's been a newfound focus on 5G, creating alternate suppliers for 5G, and especially Open RAN, as I mentioned, ORAN. The Quad also introduced other kinds of tech initiatives, for example, the Indo-Pacific Partnership for Maritime Domain Awareness. There was a Quad Cybersecurity Partnership, and again, a renewed push for standards through an international standards cooperation network where they could come together and think through what kinds of technical standards to govern these kinds of critical and emerging tech issues. And of late, space has also entered the Quad focus areas as an issue worth discussing. And again, cybersecurity, as cyber threats emerge and lurk across the Indo-Pacific. Cybersecurity and ransomware in particular has become a particular focus for the Quad. But moving from discussions to statements to coordinated and collective action amongst themselves and domestically is not easy. And that's always been the Achilles heel of the Quad, particularly on this issue and also on other economic issues that I mentioned, like climate and health. There have always been regulatory barriers between four countries. So differences in terms of how they want to regulate these four particular issues and how they're going to coordinate amongst themselves on their differences there. So, for example, there are a lot of differences on issues like data protection and data sharing laws, which could then come back and affect how they discuss issues like AI and 5G amongst themselves. Because how you govern data is literally at the core of how you govern your domestic technology ecosystem. Besides that, there are also other kinds of geopolitical differences and priorities which might differ between the Quad, and which is illustrated through, again, India's reluctance over the years to join the sanctions against Russia for its invasion of Ukraine. That has come back and affected the different kinds of tech discussions also during the Quad. So there are a lot of both internal and external issues that affect Quad discussions and which could complicate how much they harmonize standards and other kinds of rules amongst themselves on issues like critical and emerging technologies. I think for the Quad to succeed in the critical and emerging technology area, it will require a really deep and coordinated effort between all the four Quad governments, industry, capital, to strengthen different kinds of links in terms of technology, to build trusted professional networks, to iron out the different kinds of differences on issues like data, making policy and regulatory adjustments on issues like AI, and also facilitating better information sharing. I think that remains to be done. I'm hopeful that these kinds of discussions are taking place, but they have a lot if they want to get across the other side in terms of real policy coordinations on these kinds of issues. I think for India specifically, the Quad in its latest manifestation is not an end in itself, and it never has been. Right now, the Quad is a stepping stone for India to engage more broadly and deeply on trade and technology issues in the Indo-Pacific, and for engaging on trade and technology issues with other partners in the Indo-Pacific through the Quad, like the ASEAN. So when it comes to technology and digital transformation, the Quad, can, as I said, play a larger role in terms of supporting a free, open, and inclusive Indo-Pacific, and supporting rules that allow for example, data to share openly across all countries. And I think India has a great role to play in terms of influencing these kinds of discussions and rules that also reflect its own interests and reflects its own technology ecosystem and that of the agencies that manage and govern it. So there is a lot that India can do, reflective of where it is and what its interests are. I think India, similar to the DPI discussion we had, India can use the Quad to mainstream India's technology solutions for other countries. Can the Quad be a vehicle for that? That it's possible, but it remains to be seen how much leadership India is willing to put behind it. And other areas, India can also become a key part of the technology and green supply chain, which the Quad is also focused on now. It can begin to reform and reorient its own domestic infrastructure and its own production base that could enable it to produce different kinds of inputs for the regional supply chains if they're trying to diversify away from China. So there is a lot that India can do for the Quad. There's a lot that the Quad can do for India. And some of these discussions are ongoing. There's a lot of coordination that needs to happen. There's a lot of interagency coordination, not just within the Quad countries, but also within Quad countries from the bureaucrats handling these kinds of issues like data, AI, cyber, for example. So there's a lot that's been happening, a lot that can happen going forward.
Apart from cooperating through frameworks like the Quad, countries are engaging with each other through bilateral initiatives. In 2022, the Biden administration announced a new initiative with India with the launch of the United States India Initiative on Critical Emerging Technology, or ICET, in 2023. What are its prospects, and what does ICET reveal about the United States' global tech strategy?
So I think ISAT is an important moment. It's an important achievement. It's also a critical pillar that can not just advance the US-India relationship and partnership, but also channel that to achieve and accomplish a lot of the regional technology goals that some of these countries have. So we hear a lot about friendshoring these days. We hear a lot about reorienting, restructuring, and rewiring of supply chains away from China and to other parts of Asia. I think ICET is a recognition that US policymakers are increasingly thinking of India as the hub in Asia for a lot of these for a lot of the economic and technological transitions that are taking place across the region. If you look at what they've said about ISAT, their aim is clear. They think that what they've seen in terms of the incredible growth in ties between the US, between the United States and India, has largely been on the security side. But over the long term, through initiatives like ISAT and others, they hope that in the economic and the tech partnership will with India. Could be as important, you know, as the one they have on the security side. The ISAT, it's not, I mean, it's also good to clarify that it's not a particular deal or an agreement, right? It's better to think of it as a framework under which there are a lot of different kinds of conversations that are taking place on technology and innovation issues, right? So some of it pertains to defense. Some of it pertains to AI, some of it pertains to issues like biotech, quantum. It's a framework that will hopefully sustain and drive conversations between these two countries. And importantly, the difference between ISAT and some of the initiatives that preceded it is that this is not a government-to-government engagement. The way the framework has been structured is that both countries are hoping that the government will also spark discussions between the private sectors of the of US and India, between academia, between different kinds of research and scientific establishments. So they're looking at this as not just a government conversation discussion, but a whole of society conversation that ISAT can advance over time on critical technology and innovation related areas. So two areas, as I mentioned, one is semiconductors. If India is going to be an alternate regional base to support semiconductor development, then there's a lot of interest in helping American firms help invest and build in different kinds of chip R&D centers in India. Just like that quantum, the ISAT is now trying to spark and trigger a lot of discussions between research labs, both in the United States and India, so they can advance and innovate. They can advance quantum discussions between both countries. So what the hope of ISAT is to look at all these tangible technological issues and problems and opportunities and see how different segments of both countries can contribute, whether that's academia, whether that's research, or the private sector. And so that's the whole meaning, that's the whole energy behind ISAT is to drive much more expansive conversations between different parts of both countries than they've ever had before. And then government will also be involved, and the ministries and agencies in both countries will also be involved to ease the regulatory aspects of that coordination at some point. In terms of what ISAT, and it's still very early, it began last year. They've had a few conversations, and they're hoping that the framework in itself would spark a lot more bilateral conversations beyond just government between both countries. In terms of what it says about the United States' global tech strategy, it says that I think the US is willing to invest in specific technology partnerships with countries that it trusts, with countries that it sees it has an economic future with, and with countries that can add and advance the US's own strategic interests in the Indo-Pacific, vis-a-vis China, but also beyond that. I think India is a big part of that. India is an answer to some of the problems that the US has and would like to see it addressed. So technology and digital issues are now a much bigger and greater part of great power competition than there ever been. And the US, it's using its dominance in this particular area, in the technology and research and innovation area, to stitch together different kinds of tech-focused diplomatic partnerships with countries with whom it can advance mutual interests in the Indo-Pacific. So there is a lot of focus, as I said, on innovation, on research, on R&D, but there's also a focus on coming up with standards on rules on how different kinds of technologies can be governed, like 5G AI data. And my guess is the US will use these bilateral tech partnerships to think through and come up with some ways of thinking about how to govern those technologies, which would lead to a much more open and free Indo-Pacific, rather than one where the technology leads to either surveillance and control, which is the alternate model exemplified by, say, China and Russia. So India is a big part of the US's, I would say, grand technology strategy in this particular region. It's been working with Japan. It now has technology dialogues with South Korea. And it's even created one with Singapore, besides the one they have with India, I said. And I think these are standalone strategic technology initiatives, but they also, I think, put together represent an American approach to engage and to exploit their own position on technology domestically for the regional good.
Thank you for your time and insight, Dr. Nachiappan. You have been listening to South Asia Chat. To learn more about our work, please visit us at iss.nus.edu.sg. You can also get updates from our social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and Twitter.